for the most entertaining talk anywhere. Stay tuned to LA Talk Radio, your real talk station. You'll see 24 hours of commercial-free programming.
You're listening to Critical Mass with Rick Franzi and Doug Feller. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Critical Mass, the radio show. I'm Doug Gefeller and I'm going to be your host this afternoon. This is our 27th broadcast, and in response to the positive feedback that we've received, we're now broadcasting on both Monday and Tuesday afternoons at 4 p.m. right here on latalkradio.com. Usually you get to hear my partner Rick Franzi host the show on Monday, and usually I do it on Tuesday, but you know how those things go. Sometimes we switch around. If you happen to miss the show, don't worry about it. You can always go to www.latalkradio.com/critical, and you can either listen to the show there or you can download the file and listen to it at your leisure. So whatever works for you, we're available. You know, Rick and I are business owners, just like many of you listening today, and we have been creating and facilitating CEO peer groups for 15 years here in Orange County, all under the banner of Renaissance Executive Forums. That's www.executiveforums.com. And these forums are the opportunity for you to meet with like-minded business executives and work on problems that are common to all businesses today. Along those lines, last year, Rick wrote the definitive book on CEO peer groups with the same title as this radio show, Critical Mass. I would highly recommend that you add it to your reading list. You can find it on Amazon.com. Just put in under author Rick Franzi, F-R-A-N-Z-I, and it'll take you right to it. Well, as for me, I'm a master certified coach by the International Coach Federation. I'm the immediate past president of the Orange County chapter, and you can learn more about our coaching practice along with our executive forums at our website, criticalmass4business.com. That's 4-F-O-R, business.com. Well, each week we invite leading business leaders to join us on the air to discuss what's going on in their businesses. Much like our executive forums, our goal here is to learn best practices from leaders who are active in the trenches today, facing the same issues that we're all dealing with. And today we have two great guests with you, available for you. Mason Connor, who's CEO and president of Village eDocs, and Ray Dellerbaugh, who is founder of Pacific Mercantile Bank. Our first guest is going to be Mason Connor. He's a serial entrepreneur who entered the technology industry in the early 1980s. He's held a number of sales and marketing positions with startup firms during his career, and he has been president and CEO of Village eDocs since 1997. Mason, can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Great. That removes one worry for the day. We're communicating.
Yes.
Mason, why don't you start out by telling our audience about your path to Village eDocs?
Well, as you indicated, I started in this industry in the early 80s and was working with advanced voice data diagnostic and test gear in the military and carrier arena. Moving up through that, dealt with technology that today would be called ATM communication technology. This was technology that existed well before the standard existed. Was involved with local area network technology, as well as doing wide area communication with voice technology, and then brought all that to together, working as with a consultant organization for about 6 years, working with organizations from U.S. West to Hughes Aircraft, TRW, Group Health, Blue Cross, on how to properly use information technology to transform their organizations, as well as to better position them for a competitive advantage. Many of the projects we were involved with really had to do with, you know, how to get from old technology platforms that had really never been engineered just grew as they were, and now there was a need to move to a whole other generation of using technology in a new way. We actually used that skill to do some philanthropic work with K-12 education reform, and then after several years of doing that, a person that I'd known since the early 80s in this industry had introduced me to this company, and as you indicated, I've been here for about 10 years.
Great. You know, that's an exciting background. Obviously, it brought you to your present firm, well-qualified in technology, but tell us a little bit about what Village eDocs really is.
Well, Village eDocs, as you indicated, was founded in 1997. It's a small public company. Last year, our revenues were a little over $15 million. Village eDocs provides what we call as a message vision platform, which is a SaaS offering that ships business information electronically and manages it by capturing it, forming it, and delivering it using a business process management and communications blended together. The platform is designed to provide a single capability for clients to be able to talk to their constituents. What we have built is a platform that's scalable, has a level of redundancy and capability that clients can't afford to implement themselves. And because it is a service, long before SaaS was a popular term, we were doing this, and it really eliminates the need for capital expenditure for companies, reduces their operational costs, and in today's environment reduces broad technology risk that the companies have with technology constantly rolling out and changing. You know, it's hard for them to make a commitment to technology only to find out that it was obsoleted the next year. The big value that we bring is helping companies bridge the gap between their core business applications and their customers by giving them communication channels that streamline the information flow and gives them control and enables them to have the communication when they need it, where they need it, at the time they need it, which means that, you know, we technically get paid for when we do work for people. So therefore, it's kind of a pay-as-you-go model, which means as the revenue is there, they get a bill. When the revenue is not there, you know, we don't send them a bill because we had nothing to move for them. So we really kind of act like the Federal Express of moving information for clients. From our standpoint, it's a great business model, especially with the kind of economic conditions that have been going on for the last 10 years, and the fact that we have 80% recurring revenue and 60% margins. And then if people know much about what goes on here in Orange County, in 2008, Deloitte Touche in their Fast 50 awarded us number 14. Ranking, and in the Fast 500 for the United States, we were ranked 267. So we've had some good growth over the last 5 years from their calculations. And as we sit today, we have about 1,500 companies that use our service, about 25,000 users, and they range from Federal Reserve to GE to Citicorp to Domino's Pizza, Bridgestone, Firestone, Emblem Health. So we're in a lot of different kinds of markets. And we've been able to have relationships with these companies for many, many years. So we have a pretty stable revenue pattern for us.
Pretty stable is an understatement. That sounds like very enviable statistics that you've just given us. Mason, can you sort of give me a simple example of how a firm would really apply this? I mean, specifically, what is it that they end up with?
Well, when you look at companies today, they have this need to talk to their constituents in a range of methods. And today, a company that wouldn't use us would sit there and put in an email server and a fax server and a a voice server and an eForms and a workflow product and a DM product and a document capture product. And then they'd try to blend all these things together into a ubiquitous system and then try to make it to where on demand the different constituents can receive the information when and where they want it. And that really puts the company into a position of having to be an integrator versus the delivery of the resources they want, that they're trying to provide customers. And so what happens with us is, like in the case of the Fed Reserve out of an Oracle financial system, all they do is turn the data flow towards us. It comes across the Internet. We capture it and then deliver it to all the recipients in the form that they want it. Conversely, lots of times when information is coming into an enterprise, for them to be able to capture all that electronic information coming in a lot of different ways, organize it and deliver it in an organized manner for their different P&L centers across a large organization, they have difficulty talking across those P&L centers already with their, legacy information infrastructures. So by information coming in, which could be HR documents, healthcare documents, orders, all different kinds of business communication contracts, it comes in through us, and then we're able to deliver it to the right individual within the organization, and they don't have to have, if you will, this traffic cop sitting on the edge of their company trying to figure out where to get the information in the right location. It just comes to us. It comes to our traffic cop, if you will, and we can deliver it where it needs to go. So a concrete example would be Oshkosh Trucking sends out their just-in-time manufacturing documents through our system. So they have a key application that needs to send the information out. Rather than them having to worry about how to get in it to, you know, thousands of different vendors of different sizes that use different kinds of technology for receiving these things, they can just send it to us and we deal with that problem.
Okay. Thank you. That helps tremendously my understanding. You know, without getting away from the technical for a minute, you know, with your business experience, has there been sort of a key lesson about business that you've learned that you'd like to pass on to our listeners that would apply no matter what kind of business they're in?
Well, something that I believe is a thread that runs through the tapestry of business when you're trying to work, whether you're dealing with technology or people, is the concept of using the power of collaboration. And I think collaboration has impact on the perspective that people have, the perspective of your business, leadership, management, the results you're going to achieve, how you're going to measure those results, and really how you're going to achieve growth. And let me, I guess, calibrate the difference between or contrast the difference between collaboration versus consensus. You know, in consensus, I kind of look as in everybody gets together and can kind of agree on something, but none of the parties involved, whether it's two or more, really believe that they've achieved a higher plane of thought. They've never come up with an idea that they're can all agree with. It's something that they can just come up to a close enough concurrence to move on. But they really haven't taken the time to kind of do the melting pot of understanding each other's perspective and getting to a higher plane of thought of how to address the situation. And when I look at collaboration, you know, that's what I mean, is that people are working together, then instead of, like in consensus, you know, what rules the day is generally somebody who is the better debater or a more articulate person kind of wins the day in consensus. But in collaboration, it's not about winning or losing the day. It's about everybody in the room trying to achieve the perspective that the other people have in a particular matter. So when you're dealing with collaboration, it allows you to work at a level where you're making an investment in your staff and the fact that they're gaining a greater knowledge of whatever the situations are that are in the company. They're bringing the people together. They're gaining a greater perspective of situations. And in fact, that's the difference many times between, you know, different levels of management, is what perspective you can hold or gain or understand, so that you can understand the implications to the business. So even when you're working at the lowest levels of the company, it's a way for you to help groom your staff as how they work in these kinds of settings and how they gain higher perspectives. So it really becomes a feeder system for grooming your people. It becomes a feeder system for grooming a culture within the group, where people have a, you know, they'll sit there and say that they have the opportunity to share and communicate and have interaction versus just driving for a decision where they feel that their voice really hasn't been heard. And yet, when you deal with collaboration, you always have to look for that person that has that unique perspective that nobody else can understand or perceive as having value. And yet, many times it's that unique perspective that needs to be looked at more closely, especially if it's a very important decision. You know, if it's a minor decision, it's like, okay, the odds of it being very impactful, positive or negatively, is limited. But when it's a very important decision, you know, that unique perspective could be an eBay idea or a radio idea, or, you know, the proper or most elegant rollout of a new product idea. But then also that one perspective could also be the oncoming train that would make all your plans fall apart. So in collaboration, everybody looks to try to get their arms around these ideas and these perspectives versus discounting them or sweeping them away. And it changed the communication dynamics from I'm trying to get everybody to agree with me to we're all trying to achieve a higher consensus. Now, in saying all that, and it, again, it goes to the whole thread of your of how your organization operates. You know, there are some still pragmatic business things that you deal with, and that is that, you know, sometimes that unique perspective is not worth looking at, and you just need to move on. And again, that goes back to how big a decision or situation you're looking at.
Sure, sure.
Sometimes you just have to look at the situation as a way to filter out the staff members that have limited ability to work at a certain level. So it does help you develop your staff also in realizing that if you bring the wrong people into a room, you can never build a collaboration or a higher plane of thought. You know, they're people that need to work in different realms within the company.
Okay.
So it does help you better understand your staff.
Great, thanks. You know, your firm's had some rapid growth. What's been the biggest challenge that you've had to overcome on this growth path that you're on?
Well, if you just look in the last 10 years from looking at from external events, you know, we've lived through the dot bomb. We've lived through 9/11. We've lived through the financial meltdown over the last few years, and everybody characterizes these situations as, you know, the worst in history. So, you know, those just represent challenges because if you look at how many, you know, larger companies that historically have been seen as very successful have had challenges. From our internal standpoint, you know, we've done 4 acquisitions in 4 years of key technology areas that we wanted to bring to our platform, but if we just look at the things that we've brought onto ourselves, which are the acquisitions, you know, we've had to wrestle with the cross-selling from the products from the acquired companies, controlling the increasing costs of being public. Being big enough to actually start an integration process of the different companies that that we bought, and we actually started that about 18 months ago, and something that is probably the hardest, which is, you know, creating a successful culture as you look to bring together all these different cultures. And you know, when you are looking to blending companies, you have to sit back and figure if there's two cultures and you put them together, you can't just assume that what's going to come out of it is the culture that you want, and you can't assume that whatever you started with is the right culture when you actually grow a little bit larger. So it's something that in the integration process is probably one of the most important things for us to focus at, so that you know, we can successfully grow. And if you think about it, Doug, how many times have you seen a company whose culture is really the image of the leader, which may be appropriate or not, but we kind of think you should premeditatively determine, you know, the kind of culture that the company needs to have, and then actively work to develop that.
You know, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because so many companies feel like culture is something that just happens, and they don't take that kind of proactive attitude that you're talking about. You know, you also, one of the things that when we were talking before the show, I know you're a lifelong learner, and I know that you're also a person who likes to give back, and that you mentor a lot of other people in business. Can you talk about how those two fit into your busy work schedule, and you know, where they rank in terms of your importance in your life?
Well, when you when you mentor people and focus on self-improvement, one aspect that I look at when I was growing up, you know, I was taught that people with gray hair had wisdom, and it was principally they were further down the journey, and maybe as you were heading towards potholes, they could help you get around them so you didn't have to live through them, or if you were in one, how to move through it. And you can look at it in my life at a personal and professional level. I've always looked at having people around me that had were further down the journey of different areas of knowledge or expertise, and associated myself with them so that you could you know, maybe not have to live the same you know, potholes that they've lived in life. And so from that standpoint of having that kind of knowledge shared with me, you kind of look to other people as to how you can mentor them. And yet, when you start mentoring, what you actually find out is that, you know, you're the one who's getting the better deal out of it. You're the one who's getting the greater benefit, because it is the area that no matter what you're talking to somebody about, whether you consider it your strength or a weakness, that at least you know what you should be doing. As you actually mentor people in these areas, it causes you to think through what you're doing yourself, and gets you to focus and center on those things that maybe you haven't been doing at a level that you could do better at. So actually going through a mentoring with process with people is great. Being involved with people at a professional and a personal level that they're mentoring you. And I always look as in we're in the middle of a tapestry, and as we mentor one, somebody else is mentoring us. And so, you know, I'm never quite sure who's the mentor and who's being mentored in these situations. And as I said, when you're mentoring somebody, you're getting a big benefit out of it.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I have the same feeling many times. We hear the term lifelong learner used a lot. What does it mean to you? What do you do to stay up on what's going on in the world, in your field, and related fields?
Well, there's a... somebody much wiser said that, you know, the world belongs to the people that read. And, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, books. It's just reading whatever you can get your hands on. And yet, reading a wide range of information is important. And, yes, to stay up in your industry and your competition and things that you should be doing is important. You know, frankly, being able to put all those things in the proper perspective is more important. You know, it's the old adage that the proper perspective is worth 80 IQ points. So, you know, many times people read, but they don't really bother to try to plug all that information together to see whether it even plugs together or how it fits into the map of what you're trying to do. But, you know, being a lifelong learner is not only reading, but it's talking to people that, you know, have good thoughts in different areas. And just as I went back to when you look at being a lifelong learner from being mentored and mentoring, what we all do is just human nature is we hire people that are like us. We tend to want to read books that reinforce what we already believe. So part of trying to be who you're trying to create versus just accidentally becoming whatever becomes around you, when you actually are dealing with mentors as well as people that you're having to mentor, it actually causes you to go out of your comfort zone and start reading books that just don't reinforce what you already think. And so, you know, I've always been one that tried to read, as my wife would complain, entirely too many subjects and too much of it, but in areas that cause my brain to think out way outside my box, from business to you know, personal, and actually when you're dealing with, again, mentors or people you're mentoring, they'll go, "What do you think about this book?" And you won't know, and you'll read it, and lo and behold, if it won't be some dot that sits way outside your comfort zone or what you'd normally read, and it does affect who you are. So on one hand, mentoring and being mentored is really important. Reading lots of things is really important. Making sure you can plug it together in some logical manner that's at least logical to you is important. But it also says that it's really important as to who you get as your mentors or your advisors or who you associate with, what you read, because you really are proactively constructing who you're going to be in the future, because you will affect your thoughts, you'll affect how you solve things and how you address things, which is really saying that you're affecting your perspective in life and how you're going to address things. So reading a lot is really important, but making sure that you're wise in what you choose.
Great lessons, Mason. Great lessons. You know, as we kind of wrap up here, is there anything else about you or your firm that we haven't mentioned that you want to be sure that our listeners are aware of?
Well, you know, our company is one that over the last year, 10 years, has done a pretty good job of creating a stake in the ground and demonstrating that we have very powerful solutions for businesses. And, you know, I'd only ask that of your listeners that if any of their companies they work for, you know, have a need for what we do, you know, we'd love to chat with them and share what we can do once we understand, you know, what their situations are and what their challenges are with working with their business requirements, whether it's compliance or e-discovery or reducing operational costs or, frankly, improving, you know, their competitiveness in this marketplace where we all have fewer customers.
So, Mason, how would they go about getting hold of you or your firm?
Well, you could visit us with starting with a certain portal that's at www.vedo, that's Victor Edward Deva Orion .info, or they could get a hold of me at mconner@villageedocs.com.
Very good. Mason, thanks for sharing that information with us today. I've certainly enjoyed it, and it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you.
Doug, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Well, that was certainly a great, I mean, it's always inspiring to me to hear someone that can go and talk beyond just their business and is willing to share their processes and their learning methods with not only us on the show, but also with people in the community. And I know Mason was being very modest there. The amount of mentoring that he does is really phenomenal, and I know from the discussions I've had with him that he is truly an avid reader. It's been great having him on the show. You know, our next guest is Ray Dellerbaugh, who is the founder of Pacific Mercantile Bank. Founded it in 1999. We're certainly glad to have you here. Ray, you still with us?
I am, and it's a pleasure to be here with you, Doug.
Well, thank you very much. It's interesting and not always easy to get somebody from the financial community that wants to meet and talk with us publicly these days. So thank you for your brave volunteering there. Can you kind of start out by sort of sharing with our audience how you came to Pacific Mercantile Bank?
Sure, I'd love to. 10 or 11 years ago, I've worked in this industry almost 39 years. And 10 or 11 years ago, we came, a few people from our organizing board of directors came to a very consistent idea that if we could put a bank together that could bring the bank to the business, and I don't mean just bring the people to the doorway, but bring the entire bank online to the business, that we might have a new concept in banking, so, you know, coming over the internet. And the way we wanted to do it was with a high personal touch included with the high tech. Because if you don't put that in there, there was a lot of learning process back in these days, and there was a lot of regulation that hadn't been written yet on how to do this. So not always wanting to be a pioneer, but this was a pioneering effort. We raised capital 8 times for this bank and basically grew from zero to $1.2 billion in a very short period of time, the 10-year period. And we brought this concept to the market that was pretty welcomed. And we've been in the toughest markets that you just heard, not only the dot-com problems, but also the 9/11 problems. And also a very critical economy that we're in even right now, which has probably harmed numerous people, including organizations, and caused a significant number of finger-pointing. So our process was to raise capital, support this plan. I didn't realize I was going to have to do this possibly a 9th time here. But it's been exciting to put it together. The people welcomed it. We have thousands of customers that are utilizing our services. And we think we're adding a real benefit to the $1 to $10 million, although we go below $1 million, but our target range runs $1 to $10 million in lending.
Okay.
So that process,
and that's
the bank that we did.
Go ahead. That's sort of a sweet spot here in Orange County, isn't it? Isn't that almost the majority of the businesses in that sort of range here?
Yeah, they're just under the horizons of the larger institutions, and basically, if it's by industry, you know, if it's service industry, it's under $1 million. If it's manufacturing, wholesale, it's well over $1 million, and distribution companies can borrow significant amounts of money too. So we try to take the category of business that we're in and fit the custom structure to that business. And they're all different, even in the same SIC code.
So really, no disrespect, I could say a bank is a bank. How is your bank different?
Well, I think our bank is different in a number of ways. Not only do we customize the product to the customer, but we also have very talented bankers, 15-year-plus experience individual, and that's what it takes. It's not just a college education. It's the experience level. Although there are very well-educated individuals, it takes the experience of having looked at literally thousands of business to come in and help somebody. You know, most individuals that run a business have only run one or two businesses, whereas most of your high-profile commercial banking officers have seen significant number of businesses, even in the ranges of 1 to 2,000 businesses, and maybe monitoring 70 businesses in various stages of growth, and also various types of standard industry codes that most people would not look to that detail to try and put a transaction together. And that's where we fit you know, the proper key to the door lock. And that brings the client and the business banker together. And then what we try to do is to make their life easier. The last thing they want to do is make another phone call or receive another phone call. So we bring them online so that they can see everything they're doing every day, match their deposits, match their checks, on a regular basis, send messengers out to pick up their, you know, deposits, and then also provide them with the credit they need, wire, cash management, move money online, and image everything that we're doing for them on a very rapid basis. A business needs that today. Today, response time is critical to closing the transaction. And a lot of times there isn't time to pick up a phone and call a loan officer or call an account officer. So we try to put as much online as we can for them, and that way we're not as intrusive into their business. But we do like to have quarterly visits, semi-annual visits, and our minimum is annual visits to the businesses that we handle, mainly on an advisory and helping basis to get them through this process. And this process today is pretty tough, as you know, Doug.
Oh, yeah, the regulations constantly. But I'll tell you, Ray, the thing that you said that really, really rang a bell for me was you didn't talk about your business as one of loaning money. You talked about your business as one of helping business executives solve their problems. That's a whole partnership concept that really sounds like it's got a big payoff for people working with your firm.
That's very true. When you're loaning a business somewhere up to three times their net worth, you are a partner with them because they have an investment in their business, and you may be out there, you know, 250 times that net worth. So you become a partner, and the biggest part that you want to build there is trust with each other. Come to your bank with your problems. Come to your bank with your good news. And allow them to evaluate the process for the further continued business relationship. So we try to work real close with our clients on a one-on-one basis.
Okay. What, you know, much like the question I like to ask everybody, regardless of industry, what's been sort of one of the key lessons that you've had to learn through this growth with the bank that you want to share?
I think probably the biggest learning process, and we're still learning this today, and I think your previous guest made that real plain. If you're not learning, you probably stop doing. And when you stop doing, you better be in retirement. But I think the biggest learning process I had to go through as a commercial banker, I never had to worry where the capital came from. And when you start your own bank with a group of investors, you have to constantly expand that investor group. Our initial capitalization was only $8.4 million. And we anticipated having to do a secondary offering, but we didn't anticipate doing it in less than 2 years. So having to go back to the market, it's almost an evaluation process. Just to give you an idea, the eight raises were done really on roadshows that were probably in the 60, 90-day process, okay? And I'm not talking from the legal start of the documentation, but, you know, identifying who was going to be involved with it and how we were going to sell it. Today, that process, and to tell you how evolving and how much learning you have to continue in this, is that it's really taking months now to do the same amount of work you did in 60 days. In November of 2003, we raised $34 million, thinking we way overcapitalized the bank. Well, we pretty much utilized that capital not only in growth but also in loan loss reserves today. So it was a well-placed capital that allowed us to have contingencies to continue to serve our customers when a number of financial institutions around us have departed, sadly. So the learning process here has been the capital process. No matter how much you know about the business, no matter how much you know about how the business works, when you go to the capital markets, it's a very learning process. And it can be painful and can be good. We had accretive raises, and we had a gain in equity in the bank because the sale of each one was greater than the actual book value of the institution. And today you're trading at less than book value.
Wow.
Most institutions. So that's the learning process,
yeah.
I think, was how to do it, Doug.
Okay. Thanks for sharing that. You know,
You know, you made a decision recently to re-enter the mortgage business. Is it time to reenter the mortgage business? What was the thought process behind getting back into that area?
I'm sorry, Doug. I'm getting a little bit of static on the line from you right now. Maybe would you re-say what you your comments?
Sure. Well, the question is, you've re-entered the mortgage banking business. Can you share with us what the thought process was in doing that?
Sure. Well, we saw a pretty significant bubble that built into this mortgage by looking at case shilling and a number of other indicators. And in about June of 2005, we decided to exit the market. And it was very peculiar because a pretty sharp columnist from the Register, Jonathan Lancer, picked that up and came in and asked for an interview. And he was a pretty progressive writer to learn that we were exiting the marketplace and really wanted to know why. I gave him those reasons. And then recently, we have to list our business in our K. And I brought up the fact that we were looking to get back into the mortgage business because if you look at what happened, there's probably going to be about $2.1 trillion worth of mortgages that probably should be refinanced. They're somewhere in excess of 6% and some higher than that. And the current going rate is somewhere around 5 3/8. So it starts to create a business if you can evaluate where you are. We've gone from a 15% affordability index to somewhere in excess of 60%. So we brought this to our strategic planning meeting to the board of directors in June of November of last year, did an analysis on where the interest rates were going, and then tried to calculate a duration of those interest rates. And as you can see, the interest rates are staying down for quite a while here and probably going into next year at very low rates. That created a market for the refinance market. It's very easy to find out who's out there at what rates. And then to bring the proper staff in, it's a lot of training. It's a high-risk undertaking to go into the mortgage business, and it takes a pretty good-sized staff of some 60 people to put that together, which is operations people and loan officer production. So due to the duration of the lower interest rates, when they started coming down in probably between August and December of 2007, of course, they dropped significantly from a prime rate that was in excess of 8 down to a prime rate that's dropped all the way to 3.25. So the only way to deploy our assets properly was to get into the mortgage banking because the commercial banking had a very high compression on net interest margins. So the mortgage business makes sense. It's an approved business for a bank, and it really helps the community, and that's what a community bank is all about. We're not national in scope. We're local in scope, primarily taking care of the five surrounding counties. So looking at the government structure where they raised the cap on loans and they raised the cap on FHA and Freddie Mac and Fannie loans, we basically determined that we could make money in this market. We hired a group to study it. We reviewed the process and then retook some policies that we had to dust off and bring back into reality, updated those with current information and laws, and got back into the mortgage decision because of the affordability index of the consumer, number one, number two, the low interest rate, and number three, the high rate that most mortgages were at, which were substantially above the market, that made sense to refinance. The other thing is, Doug, we saw a marketplace, and I'm sorry I'm dragging this on, but we saw a marketplace that if you look at the number of homes that are traded, I mean, the used home market between 4.9 and 5.6 million homes are traded every year. If you look at the area we're in with the size population we have in Southern California, there's a significant amount of homes trading hands and a lot of new buyers coming in with a lot of help from friends and family. So we felt that we could enter this market, at least on the used home. We have never been a big financer of the construction lending on the side, which was a very good move for us to make in this marketplace, because the construction, new construction loans have really come down. Number of housing starts around, you know, 530 to 560 compared to 4.9 million used homes that are available out there. So we felt we could help the community. We felt we could compete against the major banks because they take the majority of this business right now, and we felt we could be a real thrust into this market for a fair return for our shareholders and also to help our existing customers that had mortgages out there right now. So we've entered into this market, and it's proving to be the right direction we've taken.
You know, Ray, that was not a long answer. That was a very complete answer, and I appreciate you giving us that insight into it. And also, I mean, you know, what I'm reading between the lines here is that regardless of where the economy is going, there's business opportunities if you're willing to relook at your policies and procedures and adapt them to the current conditions. It sounds like that's what you did.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay, I can't let you off the line without asking you, you know, when will we see the bottom of this?
I mean, you know, you're beginning to sound like the register now. I agreed to have Jonathan Lancer come in one more time. He said, I'm going to put you on the spot with some tough questions. And to quote him in the newspaper, the Register, which was an article on March 29th, 2009, Sunday edition, he asked the very critical question, Ray, when is the turn? Well, I think you've heard on TV we're seeing green shoots. You know, what does that mean? That is the beginning of a plant coming out of the ground. I think that's a good comparison to where the psychology is in the marketplace right now. If you take a look, I think this recession, which is a long one, is probably going to mirror some of the other recessions or the longer ones prior, and the longest ones, which was under the Volcker, Paul Volcker's regime, that this one may exceed that. And the problem is there's a slight turn that could indicate a recovery here. Now, I believe, and I'm not an economist, I'm just a commercial banker, but I believe the turning point for the reality in this place, I think the people are going to, just due to the psychology, they're going to turn the market on by going back in and buying. Now, how are they going to do that? First of all, if they refinance their house, they're going to have more spendable money. And it's really the consumer that's going to spin this economy up the right direction. If you notice, there's all kinds of incentives for car purchases. There's a lot of tax incentives that people can acquire for first-time home buyers. There's the incentives for the consumer. They're 66% of the GDP. So I believe the turn, and I said it without hesitation then, and I'll say it again, people are going to have the psychology to spend, and I think they want a good Christmas this year, and I really believe the spending is going to start in November. That's going to draw down the inventory. There's not a lot of inventory out there right now, so it's going to start expanding, and I think that'll happen in the October-November period, and I think we'll actually see real spending hit the marketplace for what I would call a very good Christmas. So whether you're buying a gift for your wife or your children, I think it will benefit the economy, and I really think people realize these are the lowest housing prices we've seen in quite a while. I mean, you look at the Phoenix market and you look at the Las Vegas market, Maricopa County in Arizona is the biggest county. I mean, you've seen 34 to 50% drops. You go Inland Empire here, you're still seeing substantial drops in houses out there, which have finally edged up in the recent statistics. So I'm going to call the shot that November is probably the pivot time, and I think we'll see real growth from there on out, although it will be, you know, fairly shallow incline. But November is probably the beginning of the better times than we've been through. And we've been through a terrible time here recently with the capital markets absolutely frozen.
We have. And I appreciate you going out on the edge there and sharing your prediction with us. You know, we only have a little bit of time left, but Just quickly, do you want to give us a quick synopsis of what you think the future is for the banking industry? I mean, you're the number one Orange County-based commercial bank. You've got assets of over $1.2 billion, a number I can't even fathom. Where do you think the banking industry is going to?
Well, I think the banking industry has to consider something very important here. They're here to support the communities they're in. They've got to take care of the client and the client base in those communities, and they've got to be willing to step up to the line and really lend right now. If there ever is a business community that needs capital, it's here and now, okay? I mean, we've done everything we can possibly do, and of course we do have to follow a lot of federal guidelines in order to be compliant. We've done everything we can do to help the consumer and the small businessman maintain their business, because we know they'll come back. Everybody right now, it's hard to buy a stock when the stock market's down. It's hard to make an investment. I mean, we had to invest in almost 60 people, Doug, and that was a very difficult time to do when we're losing money, you know, on a daily basis, even though our revenues have maintained a pretty strong, $30 million this first half, and we're still heading towards a $60+ million revenue base for the year. But it's still hard to invest in 60 people, but we did it, and it's paying off right now. So I think the time has come for everybody to help the communities build the business back to where we are. And we plan to stay number one in Orange County, and we will, if we have to put a capital plan together, raise additional capital, we're going to do it on a non-dilutive basis, and I'm sure there's money out there to find for a good investment. We think we're a good investment. So we're going to pursue this marketplace. We're going to support the community. We're going to try and have the most up-to-date computer systems we can put in so that it services the customer and leaves him to run his business. So we want to be there on call for the business and go forward with them.
Well, thank you very much for those encouraging words. How does someone get in touch with you before we sign off here? What's the best way?
Sure. Well, we have to say we're online at pmbank.com. And anybody can reach us through that, getting to our webpage. There's phone numbers, all our branches. There's maps on there. We do have people in this bank that answer phones. And you can call us on our main line, which will get you to any office in Beverly Hills to La Jolla at 714-438-2500. That's our main switch point.
Great. Ray, is there anything else you wanted to say before we sign off here that I haven't asked you about?
No, Doug. I just appreciate the opportunity to be online. If there's anybody we can help out there, all of our people are willing to help, whether it's a mortgage or a commercial loan. And it's a real pleasure to be online with you, and I really think you guys are doing a wonderful job to get to the business community, because this is the kind of help they need. And banks like us are willing to stand ready to help them at any point they need it.
Great. Ray, thank you very much for being with us today. Ray Delabar from Pacific Mercantile Bank. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay. Thank you. Well, that wraps up another day with Critical Mass, the radio show. Our goal here, my partner Rick Franzi and I, is to bring you what's really the news of what's really going on in the businesses in Orange County. Not just the bad news, but the encouraging news, and you certainly heard it from today's guest. So thank you very much for tuning in. Be sure to listen to us next Monday and next Tuesday, 4 o'clock on latalkradio.com. Thanks very much. This is Doug Gefeller signing off for Critical Mass.
You're listening to Critical Mass with Rick Franzi and Doug Gefeller.